Blog Talk Radio.
Sometimes I lay under the moon and thank God I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, I am here for a reason.
Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds,
I know someday it'll all turn around because
all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for.
It's not about win or lose, cause we all lose when they feed on the souls of the innocent. Blood drenched pavement, keep on moving though the water damages. It might drive you crazy, but don't let it make you no way, no way.
Sometimes in my tears I drown,
I drown,
but I never let it get me down,
get me down.
So when negativity surrounds,
yes, blessed souls, don't let your tears bring you down, because you've been found right now listening to blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we are the higher inner frequency of blogtalkradio.com. We call ourselves Soul Class. This happens to be Soul Class program presentation number 602, Secular by Design, number 65. Baruch Hashem blesses our Creator, shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, we're right now broadcasting on May 11th, 2016, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unified Soul Actualization. And it's 9:32 a.m. Program content will focus on reading from Alan W. Cecil's Secular by Design, a philosophy of no hide laws and observances, which can be purchased by going to any place in the internet. We have something called the search engine, and type in Secular by Design, a philosophy of no hide laws and observances. Just type in Alan's name, A-L-A-N-W, for winning. Cecil, C-I-C-I-L. The tags for today's program are Eternal Creator, Divine Image, Universal Redemption, Children of Israel uniting with the children of Noah to erase hatred, jealousy, and competition, Secular by Design, a philosophy of no hide laws and observances, and Alan W. Cecil. And we got to turn down the music. Actually, this is the music where the musical instruments are the human voices of the Maccabees singing One Day, which is a song which was originally written by Youthman Matisyahu. Just tune down the music. Oy, oy, oy. And now, before we bring on our co-hosts, we just want to mention everyone that today's program is dedicated to the elevation of the soul of my father, Reb Shlomo Yaakov Oliver Shalom. May rest in peace. Ben Huna David, may rest in peace my grandfather. My father now has gone to the next level of life for almost the past, today is Wednesday, so Thursday, Friday, last 26 days ago he left this planet to go to the next level of life. And before we go further, I want to actually plug a little bit concept in today's program. We'll be reading from Alan's book with something my father wrote in his book, Asleep at the Geiger Counter, The Nuclear Destruction of the Planet and How to Stop It. Well, with that being said, we have Rambam's student teaching, disseminator of the teachings of Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Maimari's Rambam, that Nesher Gold, the Great Eagle, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Don. I hope everybody's refreshed after the Jewish holidays. So we're ready to go again, right?
Baruch Hashem, thank God. And, of course, our other co-host and the author of Secular by Design, A Philosophy of No Hide Laws and Observances, virtual drum roll, ba-dum-bum, Alan W. Cecil. Good morning, Alan.
I think the W is actually for widening. I've got to lay off the cheesecake.
You're getting ready for Shavuos, huh?
I guess.
Okay, gentlemen, blessed souls out there. By the way, if you want to listen in, you can call in at 347-838-8669. And if you dare to ask a question, make a comment, you're also will be welcome. Okay, so now we're going to start with a quote from Mark Twain, as we mentioned last week. This is from footnote 32 from page 128 of Alan's wonderful book in the section called Protocols of the Historian. The American writer Mark Twain commented on this nation when he wrote, quote, if statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race. Actually, I think we can constitute much less than 1%. I think I once heard 0.002 thousandths of a percent of the human race. It suggests we're a real minority. It suggests a nebulous dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew's oddly hard to be heard of, but he is heard of, or she is heard of, and has always been heard of. He or she is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contributions to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, and medicine, and abstruse learning are also way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He made a marvelous fight in this world. In all the ages, he has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burnt out, and they sit in twilight now, or have vanished. The Jew saw them, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal, all other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? And that was written by Mark Twain in the Complete Essays of Mark Twain, published by New York Doubleday and Company, 1963, page 249. Now, I'd like to comment on that. Mr. Twain, with all due respect, many questions can be asked about many nations, especially the descendants of these many nations that are here upon this planet. Because the secret of our immortality as the Jewish people is that we were blessed by God. But the secret of the continuance of the nations of the entire world is embedded in that very, very small, teeny, tiny verse in the book of Genesis, that when Noah and his three sons, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, left the ark, God blessed them. And God is eternal. So whatever God blessed, and his blessing remains also in eternal mode. It's just that for whatever reason, we have been chosen, which there are reasons, but ultimately this was a choice of the Creator. But all nations are chosen to continue the furtherance of the human family experience. So Twain's question, it's a good question, but it is answerable if we look under the microscope or the telescope or the just plain black and white print on paper of the Torah itself. Dennis?
Well, Samuel Longhorn Clemens is entitled to his own opinion. And I don't think he did a huge amount of research, so he had to pick this up from other books, other people, and learning along the way. And we do have to admire, and by the way, what he said, I wasn't too sure if he was heaping praise on Jewish people or that was an epitaph almost, because there's a double edge to this, and that is that since they've lasted so long, does that mean that they're going to continue doing this? Because no matter what happens in the human world, we seem to wear things down or dissipate them over a period of time. And we all know that all humans have different opinions, and we all have a hard time agreeing on some simple things. But it's nice to hear somebody at least praising things that have remained the same over a long period of history.
Thank you, Dennis and Alan. I know Rav Hirsch has an answer to Twain, but I'll read it after I get your response, your take on these matters.
Well, I think Twain's writing is a very astute and insightful idea, especially when you understand when he wrote it, the late 19th century. You have to remember that Mark Twain was an atheist. This is why he asked the question, because he recognized that the Jewish people, the nation of Israel, broke the rules of history. That was the question he was asking. You know, why do these people break the rules of history, unlike everyone else? You know, how do they? What is the answer? Of course, you know, we know what the answer is, as you explained. He really didn't, and if you ever have a chance to read Letters from the Earth, a book that was published posthumously, it's a hilarious and rather scathing attack on Christianity. So his views were very, very different. He was quite intellectual and very objective about a lot of things.
Now, I'd like to read from Rav Hirsch's quote, which can supply an answer to the inquisitive thinking process of Mark Twain, and then I want to plug in something that my father wrote from his book Sleep at the Geiger Counter. So this is from Rav Hirsch. The answer to this question, which is also found on page 128 of Secular by Design, in a section called Protocols of the Historian, the answer to this question is supplied by Rabbi S.R. Hirsch, Shamshin Rafoil Hirsch. Our history should tell you to know the ways of God's sovereignty, Israel tells the nations. Excuse me. The Jewish people wander through the world without power and without arms. Remember, this was written in the 19th century when there was no modern state of Israel. And yet all the nations of the world shall gradually gather beneath the Jewish banner, beneath the idea which the Jewish people has held aloft and which has served as its guiding star in wanderings through time. What is this reason for the victory of the Jewish people? This victory will come about when we have left it to God to determine what our portion on earth should be. We have won the battle because we have taken pride in renouncing all personal grandeur and might, and this is the only kind of pride that finds favor in the eyes of the Lord. And this is the pride in which the Lord delights because it derives from the proper understanding of the destiny of men and nations, which is very interesting. So we shall become victorious by renouncing that which is the opposite of a victor's consciousness, gentlemen, personal grandeur and might. And this is the only type of, we should take pride that we are disenfranchising ourselves from what we would call arrogance on the street. And this is the pride which the Lord delights in. And I humbly suggest that this is something that all of the nations of the world can access through the Torah, through, and specifically through the 7 commandments. And I just want to mention one more thing from my father's book, again, from Sleep at the Geiger Counter, which was published by Blue Dolphin Publishing Ecology / Nuclear Energy. You can get the book at www.bluedolphinpublishing.com. It goes for less than $20. Now, what my father wrote about is this whole idea is that when you talk about a nuclear explosion, it's produced when you trigger in it the presence of a highly concentrated isotope of uranium. Now, what is an isotope? An isotope, going into the world of chemistry, is when you have in the same element, if it exists in two or more forms, that has equal numbers of protons but different numbers of neutrons in their nuclei, and hence different relative atomic mass but not in chemical properties. And in particular, it's a radioactive form of an element, which means it's containing itself a tremendous amount of energy. Now, my father mentioned that one type of isotope which is used to, for the making of a certain type of atomic bomb is the plutonium bomb, excuse me. The plutonium must be plutonium-239. My father wanted to mention, excuse me, plutonium-239, which is a teeny tiny isotope, is the stuff that atom bombs are made of, and it remains radioactive for 250,000 years. So here we see Blessed as an example of something which is not a human being. It's not even a compound. It's an element which can last 250,000 years. So again, even from the world of science, we see that isotopes and elements and compounds are not the reason why we're here. We're here because God put us here, and so He created these wondrous physical realities and chemistry realities and mathematical realities and quantum physics realities, but not to lose all the tree-like appearances, which seems to be the forest from the forest itself, which this is God's creation. So I just wanted to share that with you to show you again, Twain's question, it has a certain significance, but it gets smaller and smaller and smaller when you get into a relative comparative analysis concerning other things, because the human family experience, according to the biblical perspective, has only been around for 5,776 years since original man and woman. And here we see one little teeny tiny element can stay supercharged for 250,000 years. So how much more so the human family experience, which is moving into eternal mode very soon with the blessings of the Most High, through the ages of the coming of the Messiah, the Mashiach of Israel, and for all the nations. that we see that we're all moving into this mode. But we have to plow the ground. We have to remember that, as Alan brings down in footnote 33 on page 128 of Secular by Design, the survival of the Jewish people for the purpose of executing his divinely assigned task is predicted in the Torah, which is, again, an eternal thing. With 250,000 years, is nothing compared to the eternality of the Torah teachings, and was reiterated, repeated by the prophets, for example, in Jeremiah chapter 5, verses 15 to 18, and is presented as a lasting testimony to God's rulership. The miraculous survival is indeed the historical confirmation of the truth of Judaic teachings, which are the truth of the Torah teachings, which are the truth of God's wisdom to bestow us human beings these levels of consciousness. And there Alan quoted from Elias's 19 Letters, page 100. Dennis?
Well, our earth is a double-edged blade. We have very good things here, and we have some bad things, just like there are, let's say, poisonous plants. Yet, we don't eat them. The animals don't eat them, because we've learned that you die when you eat them. However, they are a thing of beauty. They are natural. You take anthrax, which exists in all the earth, all the dirt of the earth, but it's in microscopic format. If you put enough microbes together and put it all in a spoon, you would have a very deadly spoon full of dirt that will undo a whole bunch of things that God put together. So we also have rocks. Rocks are, well, they're mobile. They don't talk. They don't speak. They're not sensitive. Out of the rock, we got the U-239, 237, which are unstable isotopes. And what happens is they're decreasing in their power microscopically each year, so that they'll eventually lose their power, but they're here. No one ever told us what to do with them. No one ever told us to watch out for them, but we live with them. Most people in their lifetime will never come across an isotope of plutonium 239 or 237. However, the people in Nagasaki and Hiroshima found out the wrong way. So the destruction that occurs or can occur is inherent within our own environment. So people have to be aware that there is a double edge. And the double edge is that you make a choice. What are you going to stay away from? What are you going to get close to? So the intention is there. And just like you say, the half-life of some of these isotopes are longer than any human life. So they're going to be around for generations upon generations. Yet we don't want to have this to be the termination of generations, just like we don't go around eating poisonous plants or poisonous fruit. So we must take into account that the world we live in, devised by God, has a purpose, and we have to be very aware of the purpose.
Thank you, Dennis. Alan, your take on these matters?
Well, one thing I'd like to point out is that although there are trace elements of plutonium-239 found in nature, very rare, it is a man-made element, essentially. So this is something we have actually created. You know, uranium-235, when in its less lethal cousin, 238, you know, is found in nature. But plutonium is something that is a creation that we created specifically to blow up cities and things of that nature. And I guess you know, plutonium is just highly, highly toxic. I mean, it only takes like a grain of plutonium, if you breathe it in, it would cause cancer. Really, really bad stuff. One thing, going back to Twain, I wanted to read a rather funny quote. Well, funny because of who said it. The quote is, he was talking about talking about the Nobel Prizes, this person said, I should have compared religion with religion and compared Islam, not with Trinity College, but with the Jews, because the number of Jews who have won Nobel Prizes is phenomenally high. Race does not come into it. It is pure religion and culture. So there, here, this person was really perplexed at the extraordinary high number of Jews who have won Nobel Prizes. It's over 20%, considering you know how small the Jewish world population is. The person who said this quote was none other than our good buddy Richard Dawkins.
Wow.
So he recognizes what is it with the Jews? Why have they won so many Nobel Prizes in mathematics and science if they're supposed to be a religion? Which, you know, traditionally people think, oh, people who are into religion hate science and mathematics, but not Israel.
Well, it must be in our memes. Not in our genes, but our memes.
Really.
Okay, let's move on, gentlemen, and bless those out there listening in. We're moving on to Chapter 3, Protocols of the Theologian. And we start off with a quote from Alan's book, Protocols of the Theologian, quoting from Hirsch's Rabbi Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's Collective Writings, Volume 2, page 141. Judaism very definitely does not want to give birth to a religion from within or for the soul of man. It seeks to implant religion into man's emotions to clear cognitive and intellectual perceptions based on the recognition and acceptance of divine truths that have been objectively documented. Excuse me one second. Good old allergies. So I think what Rav Hirsch is pointing out to Blessed Souls is that for the dispersion of Torah-centric teachings, it requires the activation, which is already embedded in any person with some sort of normative or healthy cognitive processing and intellectual prowess, each one according to their blessing, that they can come to accept divine truths not on a super rational basis, but one that is that would make sense even if they had not come to realize this is being taught, or so to speak, I'm using it, you know, allegorically, being outsourced from the Torah itself. Alan?
Well, I think Rav Hirsch just answered Richard Dawkins right there.
Right.
Instead of, you know, emotions and beliefs, Judaism approaches things intellectually. That is what it's about. And the people, those who study Judaism and who are into it, approach things with an intellectual frame of mind, not an emotional one.
Excellent point. Dennis?
Yes. The last couple of sentences sort of implied that Jewish people have more intellect than other people because they're religiously oriented. Yet the Nobel Prize is not given out for the best religion or anything. So you're making connections here that is of a statistical nature, which in itself doesn't prove anything, but it states a fact. But then at the same time, sometimes you will take a human idea and sort of morph it into a divine concept. And to me, this is a little too quick to make those associations, because you're basing it on a history of 5,000 years, and 5,000 years is a drop in the bucket regarding our world.
True. I just want to point out to everyone that I don't know if there's a source that says that we're the smartest people, the most scientifically engaged nation. But rather, it's mentioned that the nation should come to realize that our wisdom and understanding is coming from the Torah. Now, a very sizable, probably 99% of these scientifically minded or mathematically minded individuals who won Nobel Peace Prizes were not, to my knowledge, I haven't heard of it, aside from one recent in the last 10 years, were not Torah observant. But yet, again, it's that there is a certain blessing that is embedded within ourselves that even if we're not, so to speak, Torah observant, we will have this yearning to seek out. Again, with this construct of going into cognitive and intellectual perceptions. Now, I have to point out very, very poignantly that there were other civilizations which, from our oral Torah tradition, which points out their wisdom. There were the ancient Egyptians, and even in the modern times, despite the fact, unfortunately, to our great pain, and to the pain of the entire human family experience 70-plus years ago, the German society was brimming and overflowing. And I'm not even, we're not talking about the Jewish scientists that were in the, that were, you know, working for, under, and forced to, till they escaped from Nazi Germany. The German scientists also had very keen minds. And there are other, the Japanese and the Chinese and the Asian and the Indian and the African. I mean, I think it was Dr. Ben Carson who was trying to run for president of the United States. He was able to do a resurgery to remove a certain high percentage of a young girl's brain when she was, I think, about four to six years old, because she was having such rapid seizuring, they didn't think she'd be able to survive her seizures. And yet he did this, the operation, and she can ambulate even after the surgery. So in terms of pure human wisdom, as far as I understand it, and maybe you gentlemen might agree or disagree, everyone has an opportunity to access human wisdom because God has allowed people to access wisdom. So, you know, I don't know, without the Torah, I don't know if we're the wisest people or the most understanding people. But when we access Torah teachings as Jewish people, and we offer this still so it can become the wisdom and understanding of all the nations, when we access the Torah, it exudes throughout to us, to the world, that whether on a rational basis, and for some Noahides who have, some children know who have, are a little bit more faith-based than others, some are more rational thinking, some are more super-rational thinking, they realize that Torah does give you that, so to speak, supercharging of your cognitive particles and neutrons and electrons and protons to heighten your sensitivity toward perceiving reality and to pursue your perceptions of reality. Dennis?
Yes, well, the one statistic that is outstanding on a relative basis is that you mentioned how small the Jewish population is in relation to the population on Earth. That's correct. But what is remarkable is the amount of success that small population of the world has achieved over a period of time. And that is not being boastful or anything else.
Excuse me.
That there are some people who are dedicated, who can concentrate and achieve more than others. So is it with God's help? I believe everybody has God's help. But there are people who are oriented to ask the next question. And when you ask the next question, you should know more than before you ask the question.
Alan?
Well, I think the key is when you talked about the people in the world that had a great knowledge of human wisdom. The Jews have a great knowledge of Hashem's wisdom. That's the difference. And I wanted to point out, too, that bringing up the Germans, these next two chapters show that why the German wisdom went awry, why they used their wisdom not in accordance with the Torah, but against it.
So, beautiful point. Now let's go right into page 131 and start to feast on the first page of this chapter 3, Protocols of the Theologian. By the 19th century, fueled by the Enlightenment, fascination with Greek logic, concepts, and ideas, the idea that Greek reason could be applied to the social sciences, gained a foothold in Western academics. When Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species in 1859 was published, it created quite a stir in the scientific community, not only in biology, but among other scientists who tried to use the concept of evolution to understand the development of culture and society. Social Darwinism, a new phrase later made famous by historian Richard Hofstadter, described the newly emerging social scientists who, taking a cue from Darwin, taught that societies evolved and grew, and the concept of the survival of the fittest blended in nicely with the Edomite concept of power and strength. German scholars, such as Leopold von Ranke, 1700 1795 to 1866, tried to turn history into a science, or at least a discipline based on scientific methods. Rank not only pioneered the emphasis on using primary sources, but also, in Richard Evans' In Defense of History, published by Norton and Company in 1999, page 15, he writes, Evans did, about Van Ranke, helped establish history as a separate discipline independent from philosophy or literature. Excuse me. The determination to strip away the veneer of posthumous condescension, applied to the past by philosophizing historians such as Voltaire, and to revere it in its original colors. Rank introduced into the study of modern history the methods that have recently developed by philologists in the study of ancient and medieval literature. Now, I just want to mention that was footnote 3. I think I said footnote 2. There is a footnote 2 here on this page where Alan quoted from Bloom in The Closing of the American Mind, quote unquote, "We are almost utterly dependent on our German missionaries or intermediaries for our knowledge of Greece, Roman, Judaism, and Christianity. That, however profound that knowledge may be, theirs is only one perception, and we have only been told as much as they thought we needed to know." So there was a little editing, I see, of historical perspective, especially in terms of the ancient civilizations and the more modern ones. Coming up, before I turn to Dennis and Alan, I want to read this next section. Coming off of 200 years of enlightenment, rediscovery, and reapplication of Greek thought, philosophy, and science, the Prussian educational system swung into high gear during the latter half of the 19th century. As the academic obsession with science became more and more profound, methodology became increasingly important, and this focus on method became an infatuation, often obfuscating the reasons behind the study. Many scholars became so enamored with works of leading academics and their modus operandi that they failed to see the flaws in their reasonings and results, particularly when it came to Judaism. How did theology affect the social sciences? Why are intellectuals, despite all their cleverness, unable to perceive theological ideology used in their arguments against the Bible? To answer these questions, we begin with the development of Christian theology itself. Dennis, your take on these matters.
These matters are encompassed in the world of the Rambam. Why? Because for three centuries, people in the Western world and some part in the Eastern world believed that the Rambam infused in his output of many works, including the Mishnah Torah, that he infused it with Greek things, Greek materials, Greek subjects, because he used their logical process to prove that there's one God and he made the earth out of nothing, or the universe out of nothing. But what he did was he used a process of logical processing from a human viewpoint as to why you can understand God better. He didn't take Greek ideas. He didn't take Greek or the basic things that are we call Greek. He used a process that was developed for logic. So he infused a process, but people like to put the word Greek in front of it, which implies that he was using whatever they thought. So he was asking you to believe in a logical process, not what the Greeks thought. The Greeks can think whatever they wanted, and they did. But we got to remember, like the Rambam did, you take the best of what you can use for the best purposes.
And he was clear about that too, Alan. I mean, Dennis, right? He didn't try to obfuscate that. He declared why he was integrating these Greek concepts of wisdom into his own teachings.
Yes, but for 300 years, people shied away from him because they thought he was trying to mix Greek with original Jewish thought. He wasn't doing that. It took him a long time to get rid of that word Greek, and so it implied that if you love God, you love the Greeks. No, That was never intended, but some people said, wait a minute, is he really asking this question indirectly? No, he directly said, the human logical process is this. Let's use it to understand one God who made the universe out of nothing.
Beautiful. Alan?
Well, I actually addressed this very point about Rambam in Chapter 7 later on in the book. But most of this really came from his book, Guide to the Perplexed, where he tried to show that Greek logic was not contrary, you know, that you could explain the Torah using Greek logic. There was a good bit of rabbinic criticism about this, but that's for a later time. The whole point here is beginning this new chapter is showing how the logic, the human logic and the human wisdom applied to the Torah. If you do not use Torah-based methods, you're not going to understand the Torah. You cannot approach the Torah using Greek logic or any other form of human wisdom.
True, true. And that's why we see, for instance, excuse me, it's one thing to read about fish in a book of biology, but to jump into the ocean and swim alongside them, you certainly come to realize very quickly the fish that you're seeing in the ocean in front of you act a little bit differently than how they're portrayed in the words on the page. Going a little bit further, in the last section we'll be sharing with you today, Blessed Souls, from Secular by Design, the section called Protocols of the Theologian, the bottom of page 132. In the second century of the Common Era, after nearly seven decades of disastrous conflict with the Roman Empire, starting with the destruction of the Second Temple and ending with the crushing of the Bar Kokhba revolt in 135 Common Era, Judaism was in danger of extinction. The great rabbinic schools in Eretz Israel, the land of Israel, had been scattered or destroyed. The teaching of Torah had been outlawed, and the great sages of the Torah, the living repositories of Jewish law, died or were martyred by the Romans. And the knowledge of the Torah was being lost, as it happened many times in Jewish history. As the flame of Israel began to flicker and die, a leader arose to fan the fire of the Torah, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, a direct descendant, or Rabbi Judah the Prince, a great descendant of the sages Hillel and Gamliel, took upon himself to save the oral Torah, the all-important explanation and commentary to the written Torah that has been handed down from teacher to teacher in unbroken transmission for over 15 centuries. He began to collect the teachings of the great rabbis of the previous generations, writing down the knowledge before it was lost forever. At the end of the second century of the Common Era in the Jewish year 3960, 200 CE, the common year 200, which would make that 1,816 years ago, after 30 years' labor, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, published the Mishnah. A few hundred years later, the Gemara, or the Talmud, was the explanation to the Mishnah, was completed. So we see, Blessed Souls, that we're talking about over 1,800 years ago, that oral Torah tradition in a condensed form was collated, put together, and this is the basis of how we maintain our traditions for the last 1,800 years. And for instance, we see here, even though things have been written down, say, like in the last 300 years, in terms of the depiction of how, say, this country was formed, or European society, there are a lot of conflicting viewpoints. Now, I have to be honest, if you read the Gemara, excuse me one second, there are conflicting opinions. But in the process of analysis, you will get conflicting opinions. And I also want to mention as well, when you read, if you open up a Talmud, you can access it on the internet, you'll read many statements by many teachers, but what is not apparent to you, but is written in other sources, or sometimes later in another tract of the Talmud, that the person you read about who espoused his wisdom and was deemed to be right or wrong in certain cases, or said he just didn't know, was later murdered, tortured, or horrible things happened to that person because under the oppression of the Roman government at that time. So that's also, these teachings which were brought down, written down, recorded for posterity, were written under the most severe circumstance of self-sacrifice. In fact, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince himself, suffered, and he sacrificed himself for this sake, because he himself was also under the flame of observation by the Roman government. It happened to be that he actually had a relationship with the leader of Rome, but his name was Antonius, but that didn't mean that there couldn't have been some sort of Roman underling who was jealous of the positive relationship Rabbi Yehuda Nasi had with Antonius, then the leader of Rome, and could have undermined him. But, you know, God protected him, and here, you know, now 1,800 years later, we're sharing such insight about how the traditions of the oral Torah tradition complementing the written Torah is the tradition we have of Israel, which has nourished our people in a conscious and subconscious fashion since then, and we believe that with our simple faith until the days of the Mashiach and onward into that eternal path that the human family experience is traveling on, whether people are aware of it or not. Dennis?
Throughout history, we have seen, and a pattern has existed, where people believe they have to get rid of Judaism. They have to kill the people. They have to make sure that Judaism dies because there's a danger inherent there. I don't know what it is, but people have done this over for so long that they sometimes think it's a natural thing. Let's get rid of the Jews because that's one problem we'll get out of the way. But in effect, is it really a problem or is it a figment of people's imagination? But it's been around for a long, long time. People are saying, no, oh, that one is Jewish, no good, there must be others. That's one of the problems with the what we mentioned in the demographics, is there's so few of them that we can pick on them and easily get away because the multitude will feel the same way. It, to me, it's a stupid idea, but it's prevalent throughout history. And I don't know what people are afraid of. If they're afraid to open their mind, I can understand that. But just because a person is standing in front of you and is Jewish and even speaks Hebrew, does that mean there's something wrong with them? I don't see that. But there are people who believe that we have to worry about Jewish things growing. Yet, they're all around us. They've been here since the beginning. And it doesn't look like there are danger or anything like that. Yet, the perception is still there. So we even have people out in California who are Jewish oriented, and they include those anti-Jewish ideas in the movies because they find it acceptable to the multitude of people. So even though the people who know better still are not clearing the air, what they're doing is they're laid back and letting things go by, knowing that the truth will come out in the long run.
Alan?
Well, yeah, it's trying to grasp this concept of the, especially, you know, about the Jews and what the Torah represents. It's difficult for people who do not study it. People were afraid of the Torah and still are, because even if they haven't studied it, they recognize in it a destructive element against other nations' traditions and beliefs that run contrary to it. This is what the fear, I think, drives people. You know, I mean, you can go online and find all kinds of this anti-Semitic jargon, especially against the Talmud. The Talmud is probably the most misunderstood and least understood book out there, and people are afraid of it. They don't understand it. They don't understand what they're teaching. Very few people understand about the Noahide Law, and many of the people who are, you know, come from an anti-Semitic point of view are fearful of it. And this is something that probably the biggest obstacle that we have to overcome is to make people understand that the Torah is not the Talmud, the oral law, which is you know, part of the Torah, as much part of the Torah as the written, is not something that is meant to be afraid of. It is something that we need to have our societies work better. Because in the last 2,000 years, you know, since the Romans took over, human society has not really, from a moral standpoint, it has not gotten a lot better.
Unfortunately, your words are very true, Alan. And I just want to point something out in terms of those who might be afraid of us zero. You know, you have the one percenters. Well, we're the 0.002%ers. We're the 1/2000th of a percenters, you know, but that doesn't make us elitist. Let's look at the modern state of Israel, which, again, I want to remind everyone, I am not a Zionist. I'm not a religious Zionist. It's something that happened. And as Lubavitch Rebbe of blessed memory mentioned, that he hoped, his hopes was that the state of Israel would follow Torah law, which means it would have to basically overthrow itself or transform itself into a whole different entity than as it exists right now until the coming of the Mashiach, Messiah. May that happen. But let's look at the state of Israel. Now, yes, we have a certain sovereignty over a certain portion of the land, but if you were to go to Jerusalem, you don't see that the rabbis or even the soldiers have destroyed the Ethiopian Coptic Church. The mosques have not been destroyed. The Greek Orthodox churches have not been destroyed. Even the Vatican has now secured certain rights to make Christian prayers by the traditionally held area, which is the burial place of King David. You know, you don't see Jewish people coming out with machine guns and hatchets coming to, you know, God forbid, chop the pieces, because this is not what we're about. In fact, historically, you know, where we got kind of like proactive and violent or took righteous action when our own people engage in the idolatry. Now, when other peoples come to our land, we don't appreciate bringing in the idolatry. But you see, there's not proactive movements or even reactive movements to destroying these other faith-based religions in the holiest, you know, piece of land on the earth called Jerusalem. And we see, in fact, it's a place in Jerusalem, to me, is allegorical presentation of a living, breathing Talmudic aquarium or terrarium where different viewpoints are shared and discussed and argued and agreed upon, not agreed upon. And that will give you some sort of, if you've never looked into the Gemara, the Talmud, an active human discussion is what Talmud is about. But it was rooted in strongly held traditions which were passed down, as Alan mentioned in the book, up until the time of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, for over 1,000 years plus since the original transmission of the Ten Commandments and the entire Torah, with including the 7 Ark Commandments, from Almighty God to Moses. Dennis, are we that scary of a people that people think we're going to come and destroy everything?
No, what happens is that's explaining it in human terms. And in human terms, we can get bogged down. But to me, whenever you bring up this discussion or I bring it up, I always think of that famous reply when fighting used to go on for the holy city of Jerusalem. And somebody asked the question, why? Why is Jerusalem so important? And the guy responded, he said, it is worth nothing, but it means everything. So the
Alan?
Corundum there
oh, I'm sorry,
is...
I'm sorry. Go on, Dennis. I'm sorry.
No, but the thing is, what does it represent to different people? But what it does, it represents a center where a whole bunch of things come together and people have a feeling for it without explicitly stating what it should be. Yet we've allowed to have different religions in one place and everybody is honoring their own portion. And yet the concept of portions exists here without anybody defining it as such. Yet they say there's so much history here, you really can't decimate this place. Why? Because it really is the heart, or it means so much to so many different people. And nobody wants to disturb that deep set memory.
Thank you, Dennis. Alan?
Well, I want, my point of view is the Jews are scary. The Torah is scary. This is what was hinted at in the words of Twain and Dawkins. What is it about the Torah that destroys idolatry? What is it that in the Torah that destroys organized religion, people who are bent on wealth and power. This is what people are afraid of. These people are afraid, and they have made a major push, as we'll see in these next two chapters, you know, to try to tell people, yeah, the Torah is scary.
Okay, well, we'll leave it at that. And with that being said, I want to thank Dennis and Alan, Alan and Dennis, for using one of their most valuable resources, their blessed time here on this earth. And with that being said, I'd like to ask each one of them, starting with Dennis and then concluding with Alan, to share one more kernel of wisdom that others can chew upon and digest according to their blessings about how to, what else they can think about today to brighten up their disposition. Dennis?
Yes, I would like to tell people, don't worry so much about your neighbor. Worry more about yourself, and is there love in your heart that you can extend to God and your neighbors? That way, you're thinking positive and not thinking about the differences, but what we have in common to each other.
Beautiful. Alan?
I would suggest to people to start looking into the logical system of thought that the Torah presents. It is different than the Greek system, but it is something that has produced a huge amount of, say, Nobel Prize winners among the Jewish people. Even if they were not religious Jews, they certainly were culturally Jews. And this, there's something about it that just produces a more objective intellectual environment.
Amen. Thank you very much, Alan. And with that being said, we're going to segue out of today's program with some a cappella music, where, again, the only musical instrument you'll be hearing, Blessed Souls, to is the wonderful, blessed voice of Yosef Kadurner singing, chanting out Psalm 121, Sher Malach, a cappella. I'll read it's eight short verses. I'll read in English, then you can listen to the music as it's sung classically in the Lashon Kodesh, the Holy Tongue of Hebrew. Song of Ascents, I shall raise my eyes to the mountains. From where will my help come? My help is from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not allow your foot to falter. Your guardian will not slumber. Behold, the guardian of Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your guardian. The Lord is your shadow. He is by your right hand. By day the sun will not smite you, nor the moon at night. The Lord will guard you from all evil. He will guard your soul. The Lord will guard your going out and your coming from now and to eternity. That being said, blessed souls, I want to remind everyone, you've got to be good. Why do you have to be good? Because the Tevatov Lehetiv, excuse me, it's the nature of the good to do good, and the Creator is the source of all goodness. And since you're on this planet Earth listening to this program, you'll be hearing this archive version. There's something good about you. So wipe away your ambivalence, wipe away your apathy, wipe away your lack of empathy, and just reveal the real you. And may this all occur in a way of a havachad, one love, gorlachad, one destiny, kulano, b'darchinom darchi shalom, kuv all of us, the kulano, but in a pleasant and peaceful way, the hamshik, the shem yisprek, to be continued with the help of the Most High. Take care, everyone.
Shir lama'alo, esa einai el harim, me'ayin yavo ezri, עזרי מעם השם, עושה שמיים וארץ, אל ייתן למות רגליך, אל ינום שומריך. הנה לא ינום, ינום ולא יישן, שומר ישראל. השם שומריך, השם צירך, על יד ימינך. יומם השמש לא יקקה, וירח בלילה. השם ישמורך מכל רע, ישמור את נפשך. השם ישמור צאתך ובואך, מעתה ועד עולם. שיר למעלה, אשא עיני אליה.
Hashem ishmor tzecha uvoera, me'ata ve'ad olam.